I'm a junior, so I have the same name as my father. And the story, though, is that he didn't want me to have this name. And when I was born, he was smoking the cigar while my mother filled out the birth certificate, is how the story is told by at least one of them. But, you know, it's an interesting name because it has such a legacy, and it has quite an aura to it. It was hard to carry as a kid because everyone yells Geronimo as soon as they jump off of anything, you know, that's more than 2 feet off the ground. But I've come to like it. It's sort of interesting to me because my name, I think, says so much about what it means to be black in America. It's a mix of several different, we'll say, histories in a way, in that, you know, Tyrone, it turns out, is actually an Irish name. Geronimo, I recently read, may not have actually been the correct pronunciation of that historical figure's name. And then Johnson means, of course, son of John, you know, so.
So what's the correct pronunciation of Geronimo? Do you know?
I don't know. You know, I don't know. So I'd have to do a little bit more research.
Hmm. Yeah. And it is a name with a legacy. You're right. And obviously you were attached enough to it to choose to use that, which is actually your middle name rather than Tyrone.
Right. Well, you know, there are a couple reasons there. One being that, as I said earlier, my father has the same name. And so if you search for my full name, you'll find the attorney. And if I use only my first initial, and then you look for T. Geronimo Johnson, you'll find me instead of my father. So that's one way of distinguishing us.
I see. And why didn't he not like it? We're going on and on about this name. But
I can't speak for him, but I imagine that there is some pressure. The parents always feel some pressures around naming their children and what those aspirations may be symbolized by those names. And also, there's also the question of how a name is received. And so, even though the first name is Irish, and we had a famous actor, Tyrone Power, it's thought of as primarily an African-American name, and so that may have been part of the consideration at the time, you know, because as studies have shown, if you have a name that someone can easily identify as being African-American or of an ethnicity other than white American, you're less likely to be called in for job interviews, less likely to be hired, et cetera, et cetera. Yeah, so there's probably some practical consideration there.
And you were born in New Orleans, yes?
Yes, I was. Yes, I was.
How long were you down there? Were you in the New Orleans when Katrina happened, or were you long gone by then?
You know, I was gone by then. So I was there for the first few years of my life, and then again for high school. And I lived in suburban Maryland in between. And so when Katrina hit, I was in Atlanta. Fortunately, I was not in New Orleans at the time.
You've been all over the country, actually. You spent time in Iowa. I see you've got the Iowa Writers Workshop on your resume, which is something that writers have a lot of respect for.
Yeah, it's a fantastic place to get work done. It was, I can't think of a better program. It was a great place to go to grad school. And then I was there recently as a visiting professor for 3 semesters and 2 summers. And it's still just incredibly fertile ground. There's so many talented writers there at any given time that there's no reason to fear that our literary tradition's going to die out here in America anytime soon.
So tell us about your journey as a writer. How did that begin? Did that begin early on, or is that a discovery later?
About 6 months ago, my mother said she found an old report card on which the teacher had written that I like to write very, very long stories. You know? And so even as a kid, I was often engaged in storytelling, making up stories to tell my parents and my sister. And so, you know, I think that's natural, though. Humans are natural storytellers, narrative is how we make sense of the world. As far as storytelling in the form that I prefer now, which is prose, that became an interest of mine after I first started working in screenplays. And I realized that the types of stories I wanted to tell at the time, I would be better off telling as novels and in written form, because I was trying to explore emotional, internal emotional landscapes, and novels and short stories. There's poetry as well, but prose, I think, deals with that better than the visual mediums.
So you're a multi-genre writer.
Though, I mean, I don't really consider myself a multi-genre writer. I'd say that my primary focus is indeed fictional prose. Yeah, that's definitely my preferred my preferred art.
And that's how you received the 2013 Penn Faulkner Award, yes?
Oh, I was a finalist, yes, in 2013 for Hold It Till It Hurts.
So before we get to the new novel, tell us a little bit more about Hold It Till It Hurts.
So Hold It Till It Hurts follows a young African-American male, Achilles Conroy, who's returned from fighting an Operation Enduring Freedom in Afghanistan. He and his brother were fighting, and when they finally end their tour of duty, they discover that their adoptive father has died, and one of them wants to meet the biological his biological family, and the other doesn't. The catch is that though these two brothers were both adopted, they're not actually blood brothers. And these two brothers are both African-American, but they were adopted by a white family. And so when the novel starts, the brother who's the main character, Achilles, is trying to find out why his brother has vanished when he went in search of his biological family. And so the novel follows him on this journey, which eventually takes him to New Orleans. And he is in New Orleans during Hurricane Katrina. So the book is bookended by the war and the storm, these two arenas of destruction. And so we're just following this character's journey as he tries to make sense of his life after being in a combat zone.
And that brings us up to the main novel I wanted to talk with you about today, and that's called Welcome to Braggsville. When I looked at what was online about it before I read it myself, I like the description, dark comedy that explores political identity, anxiety, and cultural taboos. I thought that pretty much hit it on the nail. But let me have you describe it for those who haven't read it yet. A sketch of the novel.
That's a hard question. I don't know exactly how to describe the novel. The story is fairly straightforward, but, you know, I know that it's often described as satirical, though I don't think of it as being wholly so. So I kind of think of it, I would maybe describe it as a blow pop with pop rocks, a layer of pop rocks before you actually get to the gum.
Interesting. So does dark comedy, does that work for you, or you didn't intend to have a dark comedy element in there?
You know, I think that dark comedy works. I mean, the descriptions are, there are various descriptions, and I think of them as being various sorts of handles. And some readers may be more comfortable with the satirical handle, or others with the dark comedy handle. But when I was working on the novel, I wasn't thinking of it as like falling into a specific genre. You know, more so I was thinking of it as illuminating, you know, certain quiet conversations.
Well, there are two main settings here. One is Berkeley, which is it's a big, busy, bustling area. It's an institution of higher education. It's a place that probably everyone in the country hears about, whether you've been to California or not. And then there's this small town, Braggsville. Is Braggsville, by the way, is that a fictional town, or is it based on a town that you know?
It's entirely a fictional town.
Okay. And one is set against the other. They're two very different places. One is progressive politics, and the other one is more small-town thinking. It's got this Civil War reenaction going on that turns into just an awful mess of things. Am I going in the right direction here?
Yes, 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 yes. I mean, that's exactly how those locations are meant to serve as kind of emotional counterpoints.
And then it gets even more emotional. There's something that you could almost call a lynching. There, as you read the book, you don't know if it is, if it isn't. Did something happen accidentally? Did it happen on purpose? And the same thing with a side-by-side story that a young woman may have been raped. Maybe she wasn't. She's, you know, there's all this mystery going around on that. So maybe you can tell us about what you refer to as the four little Indians.
So the four main characters, the protagonists, are the person who's closest to a main character would be Darren Little May Davenport, who is from Braggsville, Georgia. And after he arrives in Berkeley, which is as far as he can get from home without learning how to swim, he feels somewhat isolated, which is not uncommon for a college freshman. His isolation is intensified by his self-consciousness about being a Southerner and having a heavy accent. And so when he finally falls in with a few friends, Charlie, who is African-American and a prep school student from the Chicago area, and Lewis, who is a California native, a Malaysian, who wants to be the next Lenny Bruce Lee. He's a comedian. And then lastly, Candace, who is Caucasian American. She's from Iowa. He falls in with this group. They're all different. They're all far more politically aware and radical than he is. And together they dub themselves the Four Little Indians after they inadvertently at a party offend. They've all made a decision individually that offends a vast number of people at this party. And so this is how they end up bonding. And one thing that they're able to do is, you know, support each other, sometimes too much, in taking on really big challenges. And they decide that the target for their big performative intervention, as they call it, is going to be a civil rights reenactment. They do a warm-up with the legacy of Ishii at Six Flags here, but their big performance is at a Civil War reenactment in Darren's hometown, and that's where everything starts to fall apart.
Each one seems to represent a different culture. You've got the Caucasian, you've got the African American, the Asian. So what was your thinking on that? Are they symbols?
You know, I suppose that they're symbols, you know, in no more or no less than, you know, any of us individually as humans may symbolize the intersection of various historical forces. So they're different and they're representative in a way, but they're not strictly symbols, but they do each symbolize a distinct worldview.
Now, I had to think as I was reading the book, there has been so much in the news recently about the Confederate flag and people realizing that it may symbolize more than just history. But I imagine you must have been writing this novel before all of that news media blip on that began. Yet there's a real connection there. It's almost like you're looking into the future a little bit.
Right. You know, sadly, it's because a bit of that is, you know, old news. It's, you know, the flag controversy is interesting only because there are people who claim that it represents only history and not necessarily race relations, but that's a false distinction. You know, so that's sort of a puzzling argument. You know, I personally feel, I can't believe I'm saying this on the radio, but if someone wants to fly their flag high, I'm not going to tell them not to. I would never tell them not to. And I've never been interested as a citizen or an artist in muzzling people. And what really worries me about that is, you know, that I think there'll be some people who may reach enlightenment and decide that this flag doesn't represent them and what they truly believe, but, you know, more likely, I see the flag being replaced by another clandestine symbol, something that is not easily recognizable.
I wonder if that's kind of like a test of freedom of the speech, that the real test is when somebody says or does something that is so uncomfortable to you, so opposite of your views, can you tolerate that?
Right. And I suppose that maybe as a Black American male, I've had to tolerate it all my life. You know, so I'm desensitized to some extent. I mean, I lived in the South among these flags, but even outside of the South, the representation of just minorities in general in the media is slowly getting better. But for most of my life, it was, you know, largely offensive. So, you know, for me, it's important to draw a distinction between how I view myself and how I may be viewed or constructed in the popular media or in the minds of others. And the flag for me, that issue is in with the latter. It's more of what others think. It actually doesn't bother me at all. You know, I accept the reality that this is a country that has a promising future and a dark past in some ways.
Now, as a writer of color, did you feel any pressures with the traditional publishing houses when you were marketing your manuscripts? Do writers of color have to, is there a struggle writing for a wider, i.e., whiter audience, or did you get any of that?
That raises, I guess, a few questions. You know, there's a saying that you should write without your audience in mind.
True.
I find that to be very difficult. As a writer of color, I know that I'm always writing for two audiences, the outside audience and the inside audience. And so that's one inherent challenge. You know, what's kind of interesting and at times frustrating about the process, and it wasn't so much the case with Braggsville as it was with the first novel, because both of the main characters were African American, is that the gatekeepers for literature are predominantly white. So there's a period in the process where you have someone who doesn't know your experience telling you how they think you should best represent it.
Mm.
And that's probably the biggest challenge facing artists in any medium that are working on the periphery or offering sort of alternative perspectives, that you have to do a kind of a lot of like anticipatory emotional and psychological work to sort of think about how the story will be received and sort of think about how people sort of like accept or reject certain notions. And so I think that, you know, writing is tricky business, but I do think that for those people who are doing politically engaged or socially engaged work or writing about some of the stickier social topics, that they have to occupy this strange liminal space where they're trying to make things that or ideas that people may not want to hear accessible, emotionally accessible.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I thought about that in the same way that we hear about film, about movies on the silver screen, that actors struggle against breaking out of stereotypes, you know, that you get cast mm-hmm. a certain way or that you're expected to be a certain somebody. And I wondered if that translated to literature as well.
It does. And, you know, there's a book that came out on this a couple of years ago. I haven't read it, but it's an anthology of interviews and discussions with African American writers sharing some of the behind the scenes stories of the you know, uphill battle to publication.
You certainly made me think about Civil War reenactments. There's a lot of that kind of thing out there, and reading the book made me pause and think, wait a minute, I wonder if we really are looking at our history through one lens only when there's an entirely different perspective there. And I think that's basically the message of the book in a way, that there is another perspective here.
Yes, that's very true. That's very true. And, You know, I like that. I like that sort of concentrated framing of that, because that is an important issue. You know, it's sort of like being in a relationship where you have two people who had a discussion and they both remember that discussion distinctly differently, or two people have an experience that they both remember distinctly differently. And in relationships, you kind of learn to have a healthy relationship, you learn to sort of go back and discuss where your understanding may have diverged, or at least to bridge that that gap in perception. And this is, I suppose, what is happening on a much larger scale with history, that when we look back at this country, we're not all seeing the same path. You know, some of us have been on skis, some of us have been in Cadillacs, some of us have been walking, some of us have been dragged along. And I think of American history in particular as a cruise ship. And some of us have just been below decks for so long that we don't even know that we have docked and are at port.
Mm-hmm. There's another contemporary viewpoint here in the novel that is just starting to crop up, or at least for my reading experience. These four young students being that age group, social media plays a part in what they're dealing with here too. And I found that interesting, Twitter and Facebook and how that affects this mess that they find themselves in.
It's an important role in the book. It has an important role in the book. And also, though, it kind of speaks to the collapsing of the reflection period. Social media often means there's very little reflection between when we decide to share something and when we actually share that information. And so not only do we have a little less filtering going on, but we have much less context. And that's part of what gets the four little Indians in trouble when the sheriff is looking at all of these tweets that are supposed to be ironic.
Yeah.
You know, it's really hard for some people to read irony in the media, or satire in the media. You know, case in point, someone who I will not name cited an Onion article in their own defense a couple months ago when they were being blasted by the reporters. What is there to say about that?
And I imagine most people know what the Onion is, but it's definitely satire. Yeah. It's not actual news, but satire. And yeah, it's very difficult sometimes to know what's true and what isn't in social media. And in your story, how it gets used as evidence, whether rightly so or wrongly so. But it makes you think about how aware you need to be of what you're putting online.
Right. And also, everyone is under more pressure to like construct a really smart critical filter to know what they're looking at. Otherwise, they don't really know what they're seeing sometimes. Yeah.
Anything else that I haven't asked that you would love to talk about with your novel or some projects perhaps that you're working on right now?
Well, the one thing I might add about the novel that comes up a lot in readings to give broader context to the whole, to the idea and the conception of it, is that the metaphor I use is that there are a lot of cars in my garage that are not mine. And I use that to describe the various thoughts that I observe moving through my head, many of which reflect media exposure. And they reflect media exposure more than they reflect my personal experiences, because I'm exposed to so many concentrated narratives on TV commercials, et cetera, et cetera. And so what the book is trying to interrogate is like, and explore, is how you start to make that distinction between what you really think and believe and know to be true in your heart and what others are telling you about the world, when the voices outside of you are so much louder often than the voice inside your heart. And that's what Darren's going through. He's just a kid trying to find a safe heart-shaped box for his most prized possession. And the only one he has is his body.